Hello, welcome to Time to Say Goodbye. It is the 25th of April, recording this on the 23rd. I'm here with Tyler, and today on the show, we're going to talk about what is, it's something that is near and dear to both of our hearts. Maybe that's not the right way to put it, but it's certainly something that we think about quite a bit, have written about quite a bit, which is campus protest. I am sure that all you listeners have seen what is happening on campuses across the country. It's not just Columbia, although Columbia has gotten the most attention just because of the length of that dispute. And I don't know if longtime listeners will remember that I think back in November or something, we had one of the student organizers for one of the student organizations within Columbia come and talk on the show. And so, you know, that sort of gives a sense of how long this has been going on. But since then, we've had protests at UNC, we've had protests at NYU, we've had protests last night here in Berkeley, where I live. You know, there was an encampment set up in front of Sproul Hall. Sproul Hall is very famously the place where free speech movement started, right? Which is a really sort of storied part of Berkeley's own self-mythologizing, both the city and the university itself. We've had people being arrested, including many professors at NYU. And, you know, this has become the, you know, and I don't even know if it's correct or not, or if it should be, but it, you know, for better or worse, it has become the big story this week in terms of that war in Gaza. And, you know, there's a lot of angles to consider there. And so, yeah, it's something that Tyler and I thought we should talk about. Tyler, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. You know, totally fine. We have a kid homesick with pink eye. So it's been sort of 2 days of that. But yeah, I spent my evening last night glued to Twitter and watching the NYU situation in particular. I did my PhD at NYU. And so I was especially interested in the bungling, but not altogether surprising display of incompetence and overreach displayed by that particular institution. But yeah, really, I don't think I'm surprised easily by higher education and the sort of lack of scruples among the people that run these universities. But I'm actually pretty surprised by the Columbia and NYU situation and calling the cops, I gotta say. I did not see that coming.
What surprises you about it?
You know, it's really quite, at least in most institutions of higher education I've been in, it's really quite a pretty big taboo to call the cops on students. Colleges are kind of quasi-legal spaces often very often. You know, there is drinking and drug use and all sorts of other laws being broken where there is a kind of tacit understanding that, the laws outside the campus, you know, apply or are policed in different ways on the campus. So yeah, I was pretty surprised, particularly because there were no clear instances of violence or threats of violence or anything concrete that underlied the justification to bring in the police. And that was especially true at NYU. I think the situation at Columbia, still appalling, but was slightly different insofar as there were the protests outside the university seemed to have a different character than the protests inside the university. But the NYU protests, I am not, it's completely unclear to me on what basis they decided there was some danger there that required a riot police to handle.
We can get into the inside outside Columbia question in a bit, because it's something that I think is interesting. Definitely something we've talked about before on the show, because I think it kind of reeks of the outside agitators thing that, you know, Bull Connor, George Wallace used to yell about, and which has been used to perfection in every single protest moment in American history, basically, including Black Lives Matter. And that generally what we find is that the outside agitators thing is not actually true, right? That whatever is being done, whether however good or bad, is mostly being done by people who are part of the central movement. And that it's, you know, it's a way to sort of say, hey, I know many of you in the public might be sympathetic towards these peaceful protesters, But let me tell you, some new elements have come and now it's bad. And now we have to bring in the cops because of these new elements, right? It's not the friendly people, or it's not the idealistic young people that you thought before. It's now like these other people, right? And these other people have bad intentions. That's sort of the way that I think that that is kind of going. Although I imagine that there are probably, just like in every single protest, that there are people saying crazy shit, crazy anti-Semitic shit, to be specific about it, glorifying violence, whatever. I have no doubt that that's happening. Is it happening a lot? I don't know. Is it not happening? I would be shocked if it was not happening. Actually, yeah, totally. I would never believe that it was not happening without even seeing any of these videos that have been circulating. I'd be like, of course they're saying that. Like, people say crazy shit at protests. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, or what I want to talk about, was basically, like, I don't understand what these universities are doing from a standpoint, from their perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, from my perspective, or for anyone's perspective, I think it's quite different, right? But from their perspective, you put them if you put yourselves in their headspaces, the thing that's going to turn this protest, as in almost every protest, into a big issue, right? The way in which the protesters get all the attention that they desire, right? The way in which it becomes a national story is when you call the NYPD. Otherwise, it's just like some college kids setting up, calling for a divestment, right? Which is happening on college campuses throughout the country, right? Which is not in itself particularly newsworthy outside of higher education, right? But when you bring in the cops and you have all these images of these kids being arrested, then the public sympathy starts to swing. We saw it in the Floyd protests when the cops were just beating people's heads in, right? When they're tear gassing large amounts of people, when you had these arresting images of large crowds of people being tear gassed and pushed against a retaining wall on a highway, that's when the public support for the Floyd protests swung way up. Right. Like, people do not like, the public does not like watching protesters get brutalized. I don't care, like, what you see on Twitter or the amount of cynicism or whatever you see towards protests on Twitter. It is an American fact that Americans do not like watching protesters get brutalized. And that is actually, in my opinion, a great credit to the American public in that they do actually believe in free speech, right? They might hate what the protesters are saying, but they generally think you have the right to say what you want in America, and you have the right to stand in a public space and say what you want, and that the cops should not be brutalizing these people if they're expressing themselves peacefully. I have no idea what was going through Baroness, I guess is the title. Baroness Shafiq, which is just like a hilarious statement.
10 out of 10. Or
it's like the funniest. Every time I see it, I just start laughing. I'm just like, it's so, so funny. Like, diversity is alive and well. They hired all these non-white men to run these Ivy League institutions after 2020, and one of them is like literally a baroness.
It's incredible.
So yeah, Baroness Shafiq, no idea what was going through her head. It sparked nationwide protest to arrest those kids. You could not have thought of anything that would be less effective in terms of, if your point is to get rid of the students on that stretch of grass. Obviously that didn't work. They're right back there, right? You want to piss off the public and make them wonder what the hell is going on in Columbia? That's how you do it. The number of people who support those types of arrests, pretty small, you know, compared to the number of people who might think that those protesters are annoying, which is probably higher, you know? So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Do you have any sense of what might be going through their heads?
Yeah. I mean, I have a few thoughts. One, just to start, I agree with you tactically speaking that it's a mess and a disaster. I mean, just horrible judgment. I agree with you too that there have been, I have no doubt that there have been anti-Semitic things said, and I think some folks on the left have not been as good at calling it out as they, I think, should be. But that's true of any protest, that there's messiness and fringe elements and people who are exploiting the movement for their particular, you know, obscure ideological agendas. But in terms of, and you know, I think you're right, what this has done, and I think you saw this with the Columbia faculty walkout, which was huge, is that that it has brought, it has made this into not just an Israel-Palestine issue about which people feel a range of ways. It's become about sort of free speech and administrative overreach and corporate donors and everything else. And so you have people now, and I think this is reflected in the metastasizing student protests, but also in the faculty walkout, you have people involved now that I my gut is to say that they are there because of that, the administrative overreach, and that you called the cops on our students. And Yes, some of those people are probably pro-Palestine, but I think a lot of those faculty at Columbia too, are their animating conviction was you can't just round up our students with the NYPD when they're peacefully protesting, you know? So I think it's a horrible tactical error. In terms of what they were thinking, I think they're in a bind for two reasons. One is kind of ideological, and the other is financial. The ideological reason is that they, you know, people really get upset when you say, what if this had been a different group, blah, blah, blah. But I do think sometimes that is useful. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, if this had been a protest that intersected with things that could have been called microaggressions against Black people, the uproar and the universities would probably have handled it differently. And I think there is a certain kind of pro-Israel student that is like, you've been blathering about microaggressions and safe spaces and this and that and cultural sensitivity for 4 years since George Floyd. Like, why are these standards not being applied to me? Now, my point of view is I thought those standards were fucking stupid from the jump, right? That we shouldn't be thinking in terms of this sort of like safety model and that microaggressions and everything else. But to be play devil's advocate, I mean, I think there's an extent to which that some of those students are like, why is this not applying to me now? And I think families and donors and other people are also being like, okay, how come now when there's these microaggressions and cultural insensitivities and whatever, that we suddenly don't count? And then the second piece is financial, right? Which is that they're under immense donor pressure, and that, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that we're seeing this at Ivy League universities. I mean, all universities are beholden to donors in various ways. That's true of rich universities and poor universities, but it is especially true of Ivy League universities and sort of Ivy adjacent elite universities. And I think part of this is definitely donor pressure. I mean, we saw Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, break from Columbia last night and announce that he didn't quite put
it. He did?
Yeah. He sort of, he, if I'm remembering correctly.
What was his affiliation? Did he go there or something?
He did go to Columbia, is my understanding, yes. And so, you know, he's distanced himself from the university. So I think part of this is financial pressure. And, you know, I think the question is, in a certain sense, I think they're probably right. I think the problem these universities have is they have two different financial bases that they need. One is students who they market to in social justice terms, and that Columbia and NYU both have rich histories of social justice and come here for our activism, whatever.
Right.
And so that's how they market themselves to the student customers. Then they also have donors who are more conservative, and they're trying to play both of those groups, and they are making the wager, which is probably not a wrong wager, that going with the donors in long term is probably going to stand them and sort of put them in better standing. Because, I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, universities, Columbia, Ivy League universities are never going to have a shortage of people who are willing to go there.
Right.
Are some students going to be like, fuck you? I've talked to actually a few incoming Columbia students who are furious. But they're still going to go there.
I mean,
they're still going to go, right?
David Kwayon, who's like a writer, you know, he tweeted yesterday, I think it was, and he said, you know, will Columbia ever be the same? How does it recover from this? Columbia is going to be fine. Yeah. You know?
What? So their applications are down 2%?
They won't even be 2%. I mean, come on. You know, I went to Columbia for my MFA. I actually worked in the library that is in the background of every single shot, right?
Oh,
it's
right
next to that little. So I would sit in the library and sometimes I would go walk around and, you know, walk around this piece of grass, which seemed very strange to me because it was like the smallest quad in the history of mankind. It's like you'd see kids kicking a soccer ball from one end of the quad to the other, you know?
It was
like barely a soccer field. But I don't feel any connection to Columbia basically because I just think they stole my money and put me in debt and gave me a useless degree. And, you know, it was nice for the connections that I made, and I guess that's what I paid for. But the Columbia part of it, I just think that all it meant was that they could charge me more than some of the other schools, right? And I don't think that they were trying to educate me in any good faith. I think they just wanted to create a program that could occasionally generate a type of writer luminary or artist luminary, but mostly just function to steal money from kids who a lot of them couldn't really afford spending $30,000 to $40,000 a year on tuition, and would event, and some, for some of them, has financially handicapped them for life, right? Like that's sort of my sense of, anyway, I don't feel any pride about it, but I was there for a while. And I still think that the idea of whether or not they made the right calculation in terms of caving to whatever pressure that they were under versus whatever, maybe that is the right calculation. And yet I also think that if they just waited until the end of the school year for the students to leave, that nothing was going to happen.
Totally.
I imagine they knew nothing was going to happen, right? The idea that there would be violent protests on the campus of Columbia, right? There were some incidents, for example, where, like, you know, students were saying they were sprayed by a chemical agent or whatever, but none of the stuff seemed to rise to the point where you needed to replace your very expensive private security that they have on that campus with the NYPD. And I think that right now, you know, one of the things that has struck me is that the focus is on this outside agitators thing, right? The people who showed up. They only showed up when the cops arrived, right? Like, they weren't really there before. And so you've exploded this situation beyond what it needed to be for from their perspective. And you've, from the protesters' perspective, I think that this is a great gift that Columbia has given them, right? Like, that it has given a rallying cry, which is desperately needed from the, from their perspective. It has brought more attention to what's been happening on terms of college campus protests generally. And it's going to create, basically from now until the end of the school year, on every elite college campus and a lot of non-elite college campuses. For example, there was like riot police called in at Cal Poly Humboldt County last night here in California.
Oh, right? Wow.
That's not an elite school. It is a big state school. And you're going to have this type of, these types of flare-ups on every campus now. And it's all, you know, in a large part, I think you can trace it back to Baroness Shafiq's decision to call the NYPD.
Totally. She has screwed the pooch for a bunch of other universities. Like, I just,
right. I guess I'm just saying that to push back against the idea that it's like a tactically wise decision, right? Because I don't think those donors are going to pull their money either. You know, because
they or get that they can't be replaced by other donors who
Want but their kids I don't even believe that they're like Robert Kraft. I don't know anything about Robert Kraft outside of his football stuff, right? But like the idea that he would have pulled that money if the Columbia had just sort of sat there and not done anything until the end of the school year, I don't believe it. He pulled the money because it became such a huge issue, right? Because it became a bigger story than it was. And so in some ways you've screwed it both ways, I think. And, you know, like, I don't really care who is the president of Columbia, but yeah, I don't know. I guess like from my perspective as an alum, right? Like it's good for me because I want Columbia to be embarrassed, right? Yeah. I want them to lose money and I want this, you know, because I think that the vast majority of these student protesters are protesting the killing of children, which I think is probably their main issue, right?
Yep.
And they are concerned in ways that I find to be, you know, like, I guess from a dickhead older person perspective, which I try not to be, you know, like the question of divestment, et cetera, is an interesting framing device, because I think that in terms of thinking back on student protests that worked in the past, they are correct to identify that the divestment protests, anti-apartheid protests of the late 1980s, 1990s were very successful, right? Yep. Because they forced an actual question upon the administration. It wasn't like, can you acknowledge that Black Lives Matter, for example, which is an important question, but is abstract in its way. It's like, you have to do this or we're not going to this. You have to divest this money or we're going to not stop, right? Like, that's the actual thing that they can do. But I do wonder what its valence is in this current moment when that actual demand seems to be quite abstract and secondary in the way that these protests are discussed. Does that make sense? Like,
it does. Yeah. And that's kind of been my frustration. I mean, my frustration watching these protests, and not just student ones, but it's been twofold. One is I think the anti-Semitism is minor and fringe, but it does exist. And I think there's been like a push from some quadrants of the left to excuse it or hand wave it or pretend it's not happening when it is. And I think that's ridiculous. Like, if there's anti-Semitism, you just got to call it anti-Semitism and point out that it's like most students are there for the children who are being bombed in Gaza. But my second frustration is the framing narrative, which is competing with the divestment narrative, which is the settler colonialism discourse, which I am completely uninterested in. I think most of the public is uninterested in. I think for most Americans, what the salient point is that children are being buried under rubble, under the pretext of a military operation that has shown a willful disregard for human life, civilian life, and the lives of women and children. And that is the overwhelming point for me. And so I think the endowments and how they're what the college is invested in, I think that specific targeted claim sometimes gets lost behind the muddle of like land acknowledgement, you know, settler colonial jargon, which I find frustrating. But I think the question you're raising about the inside versus outside of the campus is a really an important one and an interesting one. There's a great article that came out yesterday or the day before in Parapraxis, which is nominally a journal devoted to sort of psychoanalysis and politics, but it's really good. And their stuff's super clearly written by a person named Samuel Catlin. And it's called The Campus Does Not Exist, but it's pointing out that the way, this campus panic always unfolds is as specifically a campus panic. It's not the university, right? We have this like particular fixation on like the quad and the campus as a space. The point was just that, you know, the focus is always on this sort of fantasy of the campus as this like safe space, this idyllic space on the quad. And then we always invoke these images of these sort of outside forces that are trying to get in. And I think, one of the things that gets lost in sort of the way the media frames this is, you know, if you just watch the news, you would think Yale and Columbia and NYU are impassable and they've become unusable by the students, right? And that's something conservatives keep saying, which is that, the students have a right to access blah, blah, blah. But in fact, if you look, the students have been really quite deliberate in making sure that access to, you know, buildings and everything else, except at NYU, which was blocking the business school hilariously. But, you know, if you look at places like Yale, they were really intentional about situating their protests such that everyone could still access buildings. It was minimally disruptive to other students, faculty, etc. But, you know, with the way the media is covering it, you would have no sense of that. And we just have all of these photos of, you know, giant blown up images of these encampments as though it's like the entire university.
Can I tell you what it's like to be a protest reporter?
Please.
This is something I have quite a lot of experience in, right? You show up, there's 9 trucks from local news stations. There's CNN there too, right? And Fox News is there too. Everyone is sitting in one area together. You at some point know every single person that's there. Like I would go, like Wesley Lowery would be there, for example. I would be like, hey, what's up, dude?
That's great.
Sarah Seidner from CNN was always there, right? At some point she like kind of pushed me out of, not physically, but kind of bumped me out of the spot I was standing in. She's actually cool, so it wasn't, but I, at the time I was like, whoa,
throwing like, elbows.
But most of the time you're she was not throwing elbows. She's cool. I actually thought she was quite cool, but I didn't, this is not, yeah, I just yeah, thought it yeah. was funny because I was standing somewhere and suddenly she's like next to me and gives me the, and I'm like, okay, I'll move. It's not a problem, you know, but, you stand around, you don't do anything. There's like 8 people marching around. Typically, there's more media than there is protesters, right? For the most part. At some point, some nut job comes up and does something for, and then everybody, because they're bored, flocks to the person and, you know, records them, interviews them. 6 people interviewing one random person who walked by, you know, and even if the person is not affiliated with the protest at all, right? If they just feel, you ask them stuff like, well, what do you think about this stuff happening in your neighborhood, right? Because you're so bored and you have nothing. And a lot of people are on deadline. And then at some point, something happens, right? And then everyone just goes running to that thing that happens, and they go film it. And it's just, you're bored and you're looking for something to happen because protests are generally not that big and not that eventful. And when they get big and they get eventful, they're covered as, I think, fairly. But for a lot of times when they're small, as they are at Columbia at this point, right? There is a real lack of proportion that comes in. And it is because people need to file some sort of story, at all. And so then you get a completely disproportionate sense of who, of what's happening. I'll give you an example. So I remember this happening. I think it was a 1-year anniversary of Ferguson. And there was like a protest outside of the Ferguson Police Department to commemorate the 1-year anniversary. And to show, because Ferguson protesters said they were going to do perpetual protests, that this protest had been going on for this long. And so I went there and I was there and, you know, nothing really was happening. It was quite small at the time. And then at some point, this guy with all the cameras there, like, takes out this tiny paper American flag, I believe, and burns it. And then you see like six cameramen flocking to watch, which was essentially a napkin getting burned on the ground. Now, the actual protest is a bunch of activists sort of talking, giving a couple speeches, but like basically waiting to see if the Ferguson Police Department is going to come out and engage with them, right? Which I think on that night they didn't, right? So then eventually it breaks up and people go home. I'm sure that some of the segments that were out there showed this burning American flag. Yeah. And so I agree with you. It's a little bit weird from that perspective to watch some of the coverage of these campus protests, because they do seem quite small by comparison, especially compared to 2020 when they were actually quite large, you know? But the panic about them and the anger about them, I think, stems from what you talked about before, right? The question I have for you in terms of strategy, in terms of the way in which these movements think about themselves, is like, we've now been on like 12 years of this leaderless model in campus politics, but also in protest movements generally, right? It starts with Occupy, and then it moves on to Black Lives Matter, which, you know, by the dictates of the three women in Oakland who started the Black Lives Matter slogan, and some of the organizing around it was going to be leaderful, right? Not leaderless, right? That there would be no leaders within this movement, and their justification for it in theory sounds good, which is that, well, they killed the leaders before, which is true. You know, Fred Hampton was murdered, right? Martin Luther King assassinated, Malcolm X assassinated, right? Like that there is a danger to this that needs to be, and that the FBI can crack down on the protests, and COINTELPRO or whatever can crack down on the protests by just going to the protest leaders' houses, et cetera, intimidating them, right? They don't want that. But I guess this thing struck me because, like, there's so much chaotic messaging now because of social media, because everything is captured on video. Everything that every idiot says is captured on video. That it seems like maybe there should be a leader, you know, to like really sort of give what the mainstream position of the protesters are, to perhaps condemn, if they are going to condemn. I'm not sure if they would condemn or not some of these instances of that seem quite anti-Semitic to the greater public that they're trying to convince. Right. And to just put a charismatic face on all of this. So it's not just this like almost monotonous footage of kids on campus sitting around, you know, to give some sort of narrative to it and some structure to the story that they're telling that I think needs to be there right now. I was wondering what you thought.
There's an Atlantic piece that came out, I want to say last night, that was reporting from one of the student protests. And in that piece, the reporter talked to a Palestinian American student who was described as sort of thoughtful and nuanced and blah, blah, blah. But then the implication was that this person who had a real connection and was a graduate student and was like really, really well informed and thoughtful and careful in their messaging is kind of being overshadowed by a bunch of other kids who who have no organic connection to this, you know, and I think that's the problem. And I think the people who do end up, if not leaders, because I agree with you that we're a little leaderless, but I mean the loudest voices, are not always the people who are A, the most well-informed, B, have real skin in the game, like this particular person did, and who are, you know, one split I've seen is between Arab Americans and Palestinian Americans, who are often much more deliberate and careful in their messaging, and who are not absolutist in their aims, because what they really want is an end to the war and their families being bombed and killed. And then you have, you know, kind of other elements who don't have this organic connection that are more absolutist, uncompromising, densely ideological in ways that are unhelpful, you know? And so I agree with you that I don't know that it's like a lack of available leadership as much as it just doesn't seem like the people who would be well suited to be sort of sober, message focused, sympathetic, you know, figureheads for these kinds of movements are the people who are given platforms often. And that's a problem.
But I do think it's because of the basic structure and the ideology of protests has changed, right? Since Occupy, and that leaderlessness is now the standard, and that there is this idea that, I don't know, this is something I think about a lot, which is just that, look, we have now the ability to spark protests around the country at the drop of a hat, as this week has proved, yep. Right? It can go everywhere. And yet every single image looks the same, right? Like you cannot tell unless you know these campuses, which one is UC Berkeley and which one is Columbia. It's tents and it's people with signs, right? And that the idea is that I think that eventually the public will see such an overwhelming number of these things on their feeds that they'll believe that there's a mass movement going on, right? And sometimes there is, right? In 2020 there is, but now there needs to be some question of like, okay, well, what is the actual end goal of these? Or what is the end product of these flare-ups, right? These sort of big, almost flash mobby type of protests. And without sturdy and sober and steady and committed messaging, right? That is aimed at convincing people or disrupting or whatever the ideology is to keep it consistent. That that there's not actually a memorable thing that comes out of it, right? And I think that the history of protest shows, whether, you know, Gandhi, Martin Luther, whatever, right? That people don't remember the actions, they remember the leaders, right? They remember the quotes from the leaders or whatever. And I just think at this point, look, I've tried to be as patient as I can with this leaderlessness idea because I think that the fundamental concerns behind it are very valid. But I will ask the people who are organizers, students, and protesters within our audience, right? Which I think there's many, right? Like, what is the harm at this point of seeing whether or not there's somebody who could be a voice, right? If you look at the Hong Kong student movements, for example, like they were led by very charismatic people. Those people ended up in jail. It's true, right? But that's part of it, right? That's part of being an activist. And it's actually good for your movement when your leader ends up in jail, right? Like it's just true. And it's bad for that person probably, but not, you know, like, come on, like, you know, like it's a protest movement. And so I don't know. I think that there's a part of it in my mind where there's an aimlessness to some of these protests that I don't think reflects the actual passions of the people or the sincerity of the people who are participating in them, but that it is an artifact of Occupy and Black Lives Matter that is not necessary at this point, right? There's no reason why that student who you're talking about couldn't become a leader within this movement, right? I don't think that it means that the most like sort of chauvinistic and dickhead person ends up at the top. That certainly didn't happen with the civil rights movement, right? Yes, there were people who fit that bill who became leaders in the civil rights movement, but eventually, you know, I don't know, this is such a crass way to put it, but the people who are going to be the most convincing are going to rise to the top anyway, right? And so I don't know. I guess that was one of the thoughts that I had, because it's just like, look, if you want to say that you're, if you want to guard against the charges, which, you know, I don't care how bullshit you think they are. They're damaging that this that anti-Semitism exists within this movement. I, as a just observer, will say that I find it to be, I think that it's probably, it's definitely there, you know, and it's silly to say that it's not there. You need somebody to say that, not just to say you're all, you know, you're all being distracted, or it's not there, or you're all imagining things, or you're in the pocket of you know, big media or whatever, in terms of like whatever, like, to point it out. You just need somebody to say, that's not us, right? Like, that is not who we are. Look at all these Jewish students who are protesting with us, right? Do they not count? You know, are they not Jewish? Here's what they think, right? Like, here's, and then you have several, maybe you have two or three leaders, right? Maybe one of them is part of JVP or something like that, right? But this sort of reluctance, I think, to get behind somebody as a figurehead is actually allowing any type of imagining of what this is to run rampant, right? Because there's no correction at all. And so that's sort of my big takeaway, I think, from the, you know, just like outside of whatever thing, like what side am I on or whatever, like, I don't think that's relevant even to the listeners, you know, but I think as an intellectual standpoint or like a strategic standpoint, I don't know. That's sort of where I ended.
Yeah, man, I agree with you. I think my perennial frustration with this particular issue is that like, some things like the climate crisis are complicated, right? Like, are you pro degrowth? Are you pro, you know, green capitalism and embracing technology? And like, there's like complicated issues. But this particular issue is that a civilian population is being bombed by a military power with little disregard for women and children. And, you know, it's really quite straight. The messaging is quite straightforward, or it should be. And on top of that, this is really a cross-faith, multi-demographic coalition of people who are upset about this. And there are tons of Jewish folks that are involved, just as there are tons of Muslim and secular and other sorts of folks. And to your point, it is so overwhelmingly easy to say, like, look, there's a Seder on the lawn at Columbia right now. Like, yes, are there anti-Semitic assholes? Sure. But this is a cross-faith movement that has lots of Jewish voices that are very concerned about a really glaring problem that actually most of the American public, huge swaths of it, particularly within the Democratic Party, is concerned by, right? And so I think what is a shame is just that the messaging actually is really clear. There's a very crystal clear moral case. There is this multi-faith, multi-demographic group of people who are all worried about this issue. And the messaging should be clear and simple, and it doesn't always feel like it is. And I think that's because of the leader point, you know.
I think that these students are taking a risk, right? I don't think that they're not brave. I think they would do a lot for this cause, a lot, you know, and I think that people who think they're all LARPers or cosplayers or...
No, they're getting arrested.
I don't know.
I mean, their lives...
I feel sorry for the people who are so cynical that they would think that, right? Like, these are real people who feel very intensely about it. But I guess my small note would be, you know, just find the person who's really good at talking and just shove them to the front, you know? That's what people... Like, we're a narrative species. We process things through stories with characters in them. We actually don't process them in an intellectual way outside of pure emotive reaction through images. We just don't. Like, Susan Sontag was correct mostly about that. I want to go back to something that you talked about, which was the faculty, right? One of the more stirring things that I saw come out of this week was a professor who I believe he is a history professor at Columbia. He gave a speech on top of the steps. And what he said was, surrounded by other faculty members, this is the first time I've ever given a speech at a rally. I've never talked about this in this capacity before. He said, I don't know if that's good or bad, but this just happens to be true. And the reason why I'm moved to do this is because I find that the actions of Baroness Shafiq, I don't know if he called her that. I think he did, actually, to be unconscionable. And that there is an academic freedom and there's a freedom of expression question here that I think is far more animating to the faculty, even regardless of how they feel about the conflict, right? that I don't know. I found myself, I just texting back and forth with you, that you found yourself also, I believe, getting, you know, being quite convinced by, like, what's your position on this in terms of academic freedom and
yeah, look, I don't want to, so the question for me in these particular instances is not about the substance of the protest. I think obviously the disproportionate attention the American media is paying to college campuses when there is the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is ridiculous. But setting that aside as a sort of bracket or caveat, to me at this point, the question is academic freedom as regards these particular protests. And it is the use of force on campus. It is administrative overreach. It is faculty governance. We as faculty at universities across the country have ceded all sorts of power to administrations, power over hiring, in various ways, decisions that used to be under the purview of the faculty, or at least with heavy faculty consultation, continue to get outsourced to the administration in exchange for crumbs and cookies. And what you saw in Columbia was that there was what seems to be described as a very brief sort of cursory contact with the faculty about this issue, but no substantive debate and absolutely no agreement from faculty that the NYPD should be called. But the administration just bulldozed past all of that, and Shafiq called in the NYPD. So there's a lot... the Baroness. And so, you know, when the Baroness called the NYPD, I think people way outside of, like, who aren't either as informed or as passionate or who have conflicted feelings about Israel-Palestine are very much like, well, you can't arrest our students, A. B, students have free speech, faculty have free speech, and C, you completely have bulldozed faculty governance and the role that we are supposed to have in this institution. And so I think it really is, for a lot of faculty, a kind of perfect storm. You saw faculty arrested, you saw the huge faculty protest at Columbia, you saw faculty arrested at NYU. Do I think some of those, and probably most of those faculty members who got arrested, and they were making a ring around their students, do I think most of those are animated by convictions about Israel-Palestine? Probably. Do I think some of those faculty are also just thinking, you're not going to call the cops on my students? Yeah, I think that's part of it too. And I think what is tricky, at least from my point of view, is... on the one hand, we really infantilize students, right? You know, part of the 60s, you know, counterculture and student movement was getting administrations to treat students more like adults, right? And to give them the freedoms that adults have. And so on the one hand, I don't think, even as I, you know, often talk about, you know, students as in my class as kids and so on, I think on the one hand, it's important not to infantilize them. They're over 18, they're adults, whatever. But on the other hand, there is a caretaking, or if you want to put it this way, sort of pastoral relationship between faculty and students. That's just how it is. And I think, you know, without being infantilizing about it or turning it into some sort of parental model, which I don't think is the right language, I do think there is, you know, a basic sense that these are people under my care, and that, you know, my responsibilities to them extend beyond mere education. That's, you know, part of the gig. It's a part of the gig that has expanded in various ways, both since COVID, but before COVID, and where there is increasingly a kind of social work aspect to being a professor. There are things about that are really bad, but that is what it is. And so I do think, you know, there is a real sense that you can't just call the cops on my students, however I may feel about what they're doing. So to me, I really think that's, this question of faculty governance, freedom, academic freedom, and then this sort of caretaking responsibility, I think is really now wrapped up in what's going on. And I think the gamble the administration has made, administrations plural, is that faculty will shut up. And so far, that has, to my great surprise, not fully proven to be true. I think it's worth noting that some of the most vocal and outspoken faculty have been adjuncts and assistant professors. And I think that's for a lot of reasons, one of which is I think that category of professors are less optimistic. Adjuncts feel like they have nothing to lose, a lot of them. So they're like, fuck you. You're not going to renew my contract.
You're paying me $13,000 a year. You think you think I'm going to listen to you? Yeah, oh my God. No, like, what incentive have you ever given me? Yeah. You know, like,
and I then mean, assistant I, professors yeah, who nominally have a, healthier connection to the institution and have the possibility of tenure. I even think a lot of them are like, higher ed is imploding. Tenure is under threat everywhere. Is there going to be tenure in 30, 40 years for me? Is this a permanent job? I think a lot of them are like, I'm not so sure about that. And so what is really gross to me, but was impressive about Columbians and NYU, was until this point, faculty have been, tenure track faculty have been pretty quiet, which is ridiculous because they are the not only the most protected folks in that institution, and that includes presidents. Faculty have more security than college presidents, administrators, whatever. They're also some of the most secure workers in all of America.
Maybe the most secure workers.
And then everyone's like, oh, you could, you know, you shouldn't, you know, think tenure is going to protect you. Is like the number of cases in which tenure has been revoked is so minimal, and you get a fucking huge payout. They have to pay out the rest of your, like, your earnings.
Amy Wax is still at the
exactly
university.
Like, what are you talking about? So, but I do think that
like you can't get more racist than Amy Wax, you know?
It's like, and they would love to fire her. It's not because Penn doesn't want to fire her. They just can't.
Yeah, they can't.
Dude, and so thing is, like, partly until now I've been pretty dispirited about tenured faculty, but I do think the calling the cops on students broke a number of taboos that I think you know, we'll see what happens, but I think a lot of faculty are pissed, including faculty that are not necessarily, you know, hyper partisans of the Palestinian cause.
Can I ask you a question? What would you have done if you're a professor at Columbia?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I really think they should strike. I think they should strike for the rest of the year. There's not much of the year left. I think, you know, in terms of, you know, students being arrested, I think the professors at NYU who were arrested did the right thing. I mean, they can't lose their job for being arrested. They're just going to have to pay a fine. I mean, I think, I really firmly believe that... this to me is not about the Israel-Palestine question. It is just about the power of administrations within universities and the fact that they're so beholden to corporate donors. And then just the glaring hypocrisy of all these fucking places have been blathering about social justice and have, you know, their radical history on their websites. And I mean, Columbia and NYU did not simply release one George Floyd statement. They released a raft of them. Every dean, like, dude, you can go to a Columbia webpage. It's incredible, from 2020 that has like 15 deans, like, read the dean of the nursing school. Here's what the dean, and it's nuts.
Seriously, it was, here's the business.
And they're all about like police reform and, you know, anti-racism and the carceral state. And then these fucking people.
A time to reflect, you know, and they're just like, oh my God.
These unprecedented times. And then they wheel in literal buses to arrest faculty and students. It's bananas.
I try not to get so wrapped up in what is hypocritical and what is not and use it to inform my worldview. But man, why are these colleges and corporations and institutions across America so willing to fall on their sword, allegedly fall on their sword, you know, for a protest in 2020, and they're not willing to budge an inch and go to extraordinary lengths and perform extraordinary acts like arresting these kids when it comes to this issue, right? And that is quite a question to ask, and it is one that I think, you know, is not going to actually dampen the student protest, but it is going to make this protest movement more intense until, you know, there's some sort of resolution. But I think these young people are being radicalized, and I think that it's going to fundamentally change American politics, because guess what? Yes, there is an abnormal amount and an undue amount of attention placed on these elite universities, but these kids are rich kids. They have powerful parents, including one of them who's like a you know, it's Ilhan Omar.
literally a congresswoman.
There's a story in the Post. I think it's a Post. I don't remember what publication, but it sort of went through some of the kids who had been arrested and showed that they're all rich kids. And people were like, oh my God, they're all rich kids. Like, what? I would be stunned if there was a kid at that protest who was a Barnard or Columbia student who was not a rich kid.
But also, like, I don't know what you want me to do. Like, I love calling out the hypocrisy of sort of like the rich coastal elite as much as the next guy. But like, do you want them to be poor? Like, what are they? Are they like, I don't understand. Like, you can only the paupers, like, if we're going to have a protest, I want the paupers out there. Like, what is the messaging behind that? Like, Good for them.
If your parents have a 401k, you can know, like, nothing you say, like, it's just weird. But it's also just like, you know, these are rich and powerful kids. They're going to have a lot of influence. I imagine that the more misguided of them are going to join me and you in the fucking blogging minds.
Yeah, media.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I do think that their politics and their worldview will have changed from this in a way that it wasn't in 2020. And that, I think, is going forward the interesting thing for me, at least in terms of these protests. Now, I think we should say that the larger questions, of course, are way more important, yeah. Right? But that what has happened, I think, is that there is part of me that wants to not care about these protests at all, regardless sure. how the universities respond, because I do think that the end function of them is to create a gigantic distraction against what is actually happening in Gaza, and to turn them into an esoteric debate over rhetorical things that were said or utterances that were made that are much, 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 much more difficult to process and probably more nuanced in it, you know, and then what you pointed out at the beginning of the show or throughout the show is what I think seemed as a quite simple moral issue, which is that these children, women, innocents should stop being bombed. Right. Like, and so is the other questions are, you know, better for media. They're better to write about. They're in some ways they're easier to write about, right? Because a lot of us are not experts in Israel, Palestine. A lot of us are kind of cowed by the enormity of tragedy that we've seen and are somewhat afraid to speak on it, not because of, not out of fear of censure, but just out of like, what is there really to say about the images that you see? I mean, it's unconscionable. I talk about it, before you were on the podcast with Tammy, I would talk about it, just be like, it's like, and I don't mean this to turn it into some sort of narcissistic thing. It is, as a, and I don't think it's just parents, but I'll just say as a parent of two young kids, it is mind fuck. It's been a mind fuck to see all these dead children.
Like, starving.
It's just fucked up. It fucks you up. And so if young people in America are responding to that, right, in ways that they can sort of do on their own, then they deserve support for that. But they should not become the only story about this, right? And like but that part's just obvious. Right?
I mean,
that's like just an obvious
point. I do think too, though, like I do think it's bad how much higher ed has been a distraction on Israel-Palestine. But people before October 7th were complaining about this with, why are we talking about DEI so much? Why are we talking about, you know, Harvard and blah, 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 and Claudine Gay and so on? And on the one hand, I get the exasperation with constantly focusing on elite colleges. But on the other hand, these are the children of powerful, wealthy people who are going to go on to be powerful, wealthy people. Ivy League people disproportionately pack our Supreme Court and Congress and the Office of the Presidency and Wall Street and everything else. And I do think it matters what happens there. And part of the investment the media punditry has around it is because many people in the media class went to these kinds of places. But I also think it's a correct understanding that, like, this is where the levers of power are often held. And it's not just a matter of saying, well, let's think about, you know, Penn State or University of West Virginia, who cares about Harvard? It's like, yeah, on the one hand, I agree. But on the other hand, it surely matters what happens at these places.
Yeah. Know? All these, every single president.
Yeah, like I don't think
except for Joe Biden.
You Udell Joe
Biden. All the Supreme Court justices. Yeah, yeah. Shout out to Joe Biden, by the way, for
the first I think the first non-purebred dog in the White House, and the first or the first rescue dog. They do bite everyone, but that's another
interview. Yeah, no, that's okay. You know what? I'm fine with that. You know, it's better than having these little purebreds running around yapping. I support poodles, the dogs biting. All right. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about this? I think we covered it all. I mean, I think
I do. You know, I do have actually one question for you, because I keep seeing this question posed on Twitter as a kind of gotcha. And I do, as given that you are like one of the leading lights of the sort of left free speech bro crowd, I was interested in what you thought. A lot of, you know, I keep seeing people say,
thank you. There's six of us.
I keep seeing folks be like, what if this were the KKK, or what if this were Nazis? Would you say they can't call the cops then? And, you know, Yeah. So that's what I wanted to ask you. Like, what is your response to that? Like,
yeah, of course. Don't call the cops on the KKK.
There you go.
You know, if they're marching. Yeah, I don't know, but this is like one of those things that I think is quite useless way that, you know, like the idea of whether or not you or I believe that the school should be acting in this DEI hypersensitive microaggressions way. It's like, yeah, we can believe that, but they do act that way. So, you know, we should at least deal in reality. Now, to answer your hypothetical question, then, obviously they shouldn't call the cops on the KKK if it's a public space, right? If the KKK is marching down Broadway and 100 between 125th and 110th Street, right? And they're walking by every single in a public space, and they're walking by every single Columbia building, then they should have the right to do that protest. And every student who says they're scared or whatever needs to grow up and or needs to leave or whatever they need to do. But the KKK, of course, has a right to walk down that street. Now, so does like any of these weird like khaki wearing Nazi groups, right? like little paramilitary groups. They all have the right to do that. Unite the Right, but did not have the right to run over a young girl. They did not have that right, but they had the right to do that march, and they did not have a right to incite the violence that they incited. It's quite clear in my mind. And I feel like these false analogies only work because, and here I am stepping up on my soapbox to an audience of six people.
Soapbox away.
Yeah, most of them who are just ex-debaters, probably, right?
You have the ex-debater Marxist free speech category.
We read a little bit too much theory in life, which is basically that the left needs a full commitment to free speech because of these moments, right? That in most, that we need to do away with the idea of safetyism. We have to do away with the idea that words can just in their cells be forms of violence, because then when the tables are flipped, it is always 10 times worse for us than it is for the other side on the left. The way in which they'll justify it is to point out at these points, hey, you know, this is the world that you created. These are the rules that you created. So you better live by them. And I think that they're kind of right to say that. They are right to point out that hypocrisy. You can't be screaming about microaggressions and trying to get people canceled and fired for saying shit and then turn around and say, I get to say whatever I want and you can't do shit about it, even if a whole bunch of people don't like it. You can't.
I mean,
and so an embrace of free speech as a left principle is not something that is particularly foreign to anybody. It is certainly the foundations of free speech movement are definitely on the left. It is an idea that I think a lot of Americans still find sacrosanct as a part of the American ethic, as part of what makes America America, is that you can say whatever the fuck you want. And I don't understand, and I've never understood, why so many people on our side of things are allergic to that idea, except for the very sad conclusion that I sometimes come to, that because doing so is not in their best interest, and that it is actually better for them to have a fluid understanding of it, so that when these pressure points arise, that they can sort of navigate them in a way that benefits them the most. And that is a shitty way to think about people. But man, I'm just so tired of this stuff. These examples present themselves all the time, where the left or whatever, peaceniks, whatever you want to say, are being crushed. There's a very easy response to that, which is, you know, this is my First Amendment right. But to have that type of moral authority, you have to be consistent about it. And I think there are many people who are that way. But I've been on this soapbox for 10 years now. And let me tell you, I have a lot of unpopular takes. It is by far my least popular.
That's wild to me.
Nobody agrees with me.
I'm coming around. You know? I did not agree with you, but I am like, I was like a 7 out of 10 on the radical free speech, and I'm like moving to an 8, 9. Yeah. I mean,
okay.
The thing I will say too is just like
the people I can convince are the people I talk to for an hour and a half podcast. Every
Wear
week. They have to hear me so much, and they have to tolerate me that sometimes I can
move them
from a 7 to an 8.
I mean, the thing that I always like think about is like, if you believe speech is violence or can be violence, nobody's in favor of free violence, right? Like, if, like, you know what I mean? And it's, I think the thing that gets lost in a lot of this is that the pro-Israel side is rationally applying the same standards that were in place only a couple years ago for different groups of people. And they're saying, this is a microaggression. This is culturally insensitive. So we, you know, you got to shut it down. Or words can be violence. My feelings are hurt. Therefore, these protests are unsafe because they're violent, you know? And if you have this model that speech can be violence, of course, nobody's in favor of free violence. No one is in favor of, you know, political violence. And so if you, so it's right. Like a rational application of the idea that speech is violence.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Right. Especially when it's so ubiquitous, right? So, you know, the dean I spoke to at the law school who I wrote the article about, you know, he said that, well, what if they had made that poster about a black dean? Can you imagine what the outrage would be? And I agree. I agree that there would be more outrage, right? And but I think that it's silly to make those types of analogies sometimes. But it is also human to make those analogies, right? And it also does engage with something that is real, which is the way in which these things get meted out by not just the public, but also by administrations and people who actually are making actual decisions about this stuff. And so, yeah, just to go back to our earlier point, it should be consistent. If you and I were in charge of the universities, I think it would be more consistent. Would we have more kids saying bad shit at our school? Maybe. But, you know, I think that those kids would probably face social censure that would be pretty bad, right? But, like, we shouldn't be the ones that interfere in it. And I would dislike them if they said racist stuff, but I would just be like, well, I don't know. Like, you know, like just ignore it, you know, like, and that's, I think in the end, the thing that I just don't, I think that I will say, you can ignore shit and you cannot give people air. You cannot give people the attention that they seek. And so at our imaginary university, Tyler, that is our abiding ethos. I've told this story in the podcast before. I'll tell it again. Chapel Hill, North Carolina, is seen as like the progressive haven of North Carolina and is ridiculed as such by many people, including Jesse Helms, for many years, which when the North Carolina Zoo was being built, he said, why don't you just put a fence around Chapel Hill? As such, it is this place where a lot of hate groups go to troll. And so the KKK comes. And, you know, I think when I was a child, there was always a story that the KKK has come march down Franklin Street, which is the main street in town. And the response was always, we should just ignore them. We should always just ignore them. Nobody show up. Don't give them what they want. You know, don't give them any attention, but don't block them. And they never came. They came in, I think, 1984 or something like that. But I wasn't living there at the time. When alt-right groups marched in Chapel Hill, you know, like I think in when the Confederate soldier was removed from campus, there is a full-throated response. On campus, there were fights, there was all sorts of stuff. There were people, counter-protesters, everything. It gave those people much more credit and much more attention than they deserved. I wish that people had been able to ignore them still. And that just ignore them part, I think is like not really in the basket of responses that a lot of young people have these days. And I don't want to lecture the young people and tell them what they should do. But I will just say that from this 44-year-old's perspective, that some ignoring is okay to do from time to time, right? And so this dude, Shai Davidi, who's like always on Twitter. Actually, can we point that out, Tyler? I think that you and Jane Costin, also a former guest on the show and one of my friends, was were responsible for the funniest moment in Twitter in 3 years when... when you pointed out, I think Jane who pointed it out, that like under a Shai Davidi tweet, which was about like, it was a video of him saying like,
call the National Guard.
It was basically, call the National Guard or like this disruption is happening. And it was like the most peaceful thing that you can imagine, which is like some students were praying on the quad.
Like blue skies.
That right, like Mike Cernovich.
Jesse Singal.
Who, Nicole Hannah-Jones, Jesse Singal, Sohrab, Zaid Jelani. It was like really the UN Council of like online factions all responded to say, what is going on here? I think it's okay to ignore
Everyone keeps saying he's an Israeli plant. I'm like, he's not. He's just nuts. Like, he would be the worst spy of all time. He's like, what are you talking about?
I think it's okay to ignore totally. People like that, not give them the attention want. Don't, you know, if he's going to just sort of say horrific things about Arab and Muslim students mm-hmm. on campus, if he's going to threaten the students, until I actually see one of those threats turn into something, some sort of action, then I just don't want to hear about it. And the idea that he was the one that pressured Baroness to call the cops, I just don't believe that. I think she probably hates him and she probably wishes he 100%. Would go away, you know, but like the,
I do so want to like, say that, you know, I don't know,
I think it's okay to ignore
I agree I did think I'm sure you saw that he had his ID revoked at Columbia because he wanted to organize a protest in the same space as the Palestine encampment. And I, you know, as much as I find that guy loathsome and ridiculous, and increasingly I actually feel a little bad for him. Like, if you, he's like very unhinged. But regardless, I wasn't sure how I felt about them revoking his ID.
All right. No, they
I was
do
just
that.
Like just that.
Do his protest.
And their logic, I read some of the emails, was that, well, our policy at the university is not to have to counter protests are like quarantined separately and blah, blah, blah. It was ridiculous. And I was like, you know what? A, you're just giving him what he wants. And B, I mean, I just thought it was pretty unjustifiable unless there was some specific credible threat that he was trying to physically engage the protesters, which I have not seen. I don't know.
The first, I mean, he's like he just like basically owns himself every single time, you know, he does something like that. I mean, the counter protesters have free expression rights too. They should be able to organize whatever protests they want. And, you know, I'm not so stupid to think it would be great because the two sides would be next to each other and they would exchange ideas and learn. Yeah. Like, no. But, you know, you got to let them do what they're going to do too, you know, and you have to let them feel like they're being heard too. And you have to let them express whatever they want too. But yeah, I don't know. It is interesting. I think the past few weeks have taught me that, man, it's even lonelier than I thought out here on radical free
speech. Well, you've gained one convert, Jay.
you're like closer to your boat has inched closer to the shores.
No, I mean, I think you're right. Like, I just think there's not.
I don't even know who's on it with. It's like me and Tim Pool, you know, just like two Korean dudes. Tim Pool's grandmother's like
Free Speech Island.
Like that. Yeah, me and Tim Pool on Free Speech Island, surfing and skating up. You know, like you ask people, hey, you want to come on Free Speech Island with me and Tim Pool? And justifiably, everyone's like, absolutely not.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. Well, whatever. Still, we persist.
Well, you're winning, I think, man. Well, I think you're.
I am
maybe not
in
numbers,
winning,
but I think
but,
it's
you know.
I don't know. I'm just I will say I have talked to more leftists who are like, you know, I really do think we got to recover some of this free speech thing because it is not going so hot. So I think there might be I think they're quiet about it because they don't want to get yelled at like you. But I do think there are more people coming around to Free Speech Island than you.
There is a masochistic vibe to it, I think, at some level. Right. Which is just that, you know. I don't think it's contrarian because I think it's a mainstream view, but it's, I don't know. It's just kind of like, well, how about we, and it's also kind of hard to like repeatedly write about because you just have to dismiss all the nuances of the situation.
It's like inherently an unnuanced position.
Yeah. It's just like, it's an absolutist position because it's absolutist. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Well, thank you for listening to the show. We do this every week. If you'd like to help support the show, it is $5 a month at goodbye.substack.com or patreon.com/ttsgpod. If you'd like to email us, it's timetosaygoodbyepod@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at ttsgpod. Tyler, until next week, it's been a pleasure as always. All right.